This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Paul Arrigo of Visit Baton Rouge. He has some ideas to convey regarding big happenings in our community this month and for 2014. Also, Elizabeth Partridge on the remarkable career of the photographer Dorothea Lange, and Max Collins. His book is about the Kennedy assassination, a novel with a new look featuring the detective Nathan Heller, Max Allen Collins, who is a protege of Mickey Spillane, takes a look at the JFK assassination and the Warren Report. All this, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our guest is Elizabeth Partridge. She grew up and lives in Berkeley, California. And her father, Rondell, decided at 17 to become a photographer. And his mother, Imogen Cunningham, sent him to work with her family friend, Dorothea Lange. And that's the focus of Elizabeth's book, Dorothea Lange, Her Lifetime in Photography. Dorothea captured some of the last century's most significant events with compassion and eloquence in a stunning survey of her life and work. Dorothea Lange, Grab a Hunk of Lightning, is a celebration of one of the 20th century's most influential photographers. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning.
Well, why is Dorothea so popular? And we're talking about a lady who died in 1965, almost a half century after her departure.
Partly because we can look at her photography now through a historical lens, where we can look back and say, wow, this really documented a significant chunk of the 20th century. Also, Dorothea took a photograph almost everybody in America knows, which is the migrant mother, a woman with three bedraggled children around her who's in a pea picker's camp in 1936, been stalled out by a freeze, and she's... It's a close-up of her face with her hand up to her face, and you just feel this tremendous surge of compassion for this woman who has small children to take care of and very, very few resources.
It's the photo that's on the cover, and it's one of the most iconic photographs of the 20th century. A beautiful woman, despite her obvious pain. What happened to her, do we know?
Actually, we do. She ended up settling in California. She had, I believe, seven children, and they all flourished here in California, and she ended up having a good life. But, you know, it was a hard road getting out here and getting settled and getting set up.
Well, unlike other well-known photographers of the last century, Dorothea didn't specialize in taking photos of the rich and famous and the well-heeled. She captured ordinary people, didn't she?
That's right. What she tried to do in her early photography, where she was photographing the Great Depression, she tried to show how people retained their dignity in absolutely terrible conditions. Then she went on to photograph the Japanese-American internment because she was absolutely opposed to it, but the government asked her to document what was going on. So again, she made these very beautiful, compassionate photographs of an extremely difficult time. Then way late in her life, she went on several world tours with her husband, who was working for USAID, and she photographed in completely different circumstances where she didn't know the issues that were going on for people, and her photography became very lyrical and beautiful.
It is beautiful, and it's a magnificent collection of photographs in the book, Dorothea Lange, Her Lifetime in Photographs, and all black and white.
Right, right, yeah. Actually, I've seen some colorized versions of Migrant Mother recently, and they're very distracting. The simplicity of black and white really can make an impact that you just don't get with a color photograph.
It does, and it's in some ways a lost art.
Yeah, it is. It would be interesting to see what people do now with all the tools that we have, like... I'm just forgetting the name of it, but, you know, you can convert a color photograph to a black and white photograph digitally and see the difference in the impact of the photograph between the two versions.
Well, Well, there's some great photos of people who were not captured by anybody other than Dorothea in the last century. Here's one, an ex-slave with a long memory, Alabama, 1937.
Yeah, isn't that a beautiful photograph?
It is.
Yeah, that's just, you know, Dorothea's work through the South was one of the particular areas that fascinated me as I was putting together this book, because she had to shift in what she was trying to do with her photography. When she photographed in California, she was photographing a lot of Okies who'd been blown off the land. So she was working with people who'd been torn away from their roots. When she got to the South and she photographed several years running, she went, drove through the South, walked up to people again and again saying, I'm from the government. I'm here to photograph conditions. What she tried to do in the South was photograph how people were bound up with the land and the social structure she found there. So it was a, it's a beautifully interesting shift in her work. There's another gorgeous photograph she did called Crossroads Store, where you just see this beautiful old wooden shacky to us looking building with a gas pump in front and a white man standing in the doorway and five black men sitting on the porch. And it just says so much about social structure at that time.
There are two photos in the book from 1937 on separate pages. One, an African-American woman working from 6A to 7P for $1, hoeing cotton. And another, a white male, a sharecropper on a $5 a month furnish. The black woman is in Clarksdale, Mississippi. The white man is in Macon County, Georgia. And when you look at their eyes, you see the anguish that goes with the territory.
Yeah, thank you so much for pointing this spread in the book out, these two photographs. I put those two photographs together, and just it's one of my favorite spreads in the whole book. I love these two photographs together. And the cotton hoer, the young woman, I had never seen that photograph before. It's never been published. I was able to ask the Library of Congress to digitally reproduce it for me so I could put it in this book. I think it's just the most beautiful photograph.
It
is. And you see, yeah, you see that for both of these people, the black woman, the white man, life is hard. You know, these are not people who have an easy life.
Quite often we want to celebrate what is great about the world around us. Dorothea took no pain or any exception to going to places others did not. Did it have an effect on her?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Yes. One way it affected her that was very difficult is she was a very empathic woman who felt very deeply for the people she was photographing. And she began having ulcer problems. They became really acute for her during the Japanese-American internment. She just saw that as the erosion of all of our civil liberties, that you could choose to take a group of people based on the blood that ran through their veins, as she said, and put them in a jail situation. So at that point, her health started to really go downhill. That followed years of incredibly hard work out on the road, just where she would push herself from, you know, daylight to the end of the day. She would push herself to get photographs. So she worked just incredibly hard hours. I will say that, you know, it's an interesting situation she was in also, because there was so much need. Wherever she would go and photograph, there was just desperate need for even, you know, basics like food and sanitation. But my dad has told me that, you know, he was working with her during these years when she was out photographing in the fields. And he said that they had a policy that Dorothea set up, which was never, ever give anybody a handout, because you just couldn't. There was not, you know, there was nothing they had that could go around to meet the need that they had, that they had to concentrate on the value of getting those images printed up and back to Washington, D.C., where Roy Stryker, who was head of the Farm Security Administration, he would work to get those photographs put out in magazines and newspapers and given to congressmen to create change so that overall conditions would be better.
Well, you note in detail, by virtue of her work, that her last decade alive, she went abroad and did some of her best work shortly before she died.
And that's a whole kind of her work that people are not familiar with, because it hasn't been publicized as well as her earlier work. But it's, you know, she considered herself a documentary photographer. And she disparaged the idea of being an artist. She thought artists were a little too full of themselves. And she kind of, she stayed away from that label. But then at the very end of her life, she was freed up from trying to make a social statement with her work. And it was very liberating to her. And she photographed what she knew. She photographed people in the fields in Korea. She photographed a Pashtun warrior in Khyber Pass in Afghanistan. She photographed the kinds of situations, shopping, doorways, things that she knew, but she didn't know the particulars of the situation. And it freed her up to this very lyrical kind of photography where, at the very end of her life, she admitted perhaps she was an artist.
There you go. You have some you have some photographs of Dorothea. She's certainly an attractive lady. Did she like to be photographed?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't know that she particularly sought to be photographed. One of the interesting things about going through her body of work, there's only one photograph she took of herself, or even a part of herself. Some photographers photograph themselves all the time. They photograph their shadow. They photograph themselves in a mirror. They set up a photograph. Dorothea had no interest in photographing herself, except she took one photograph of her right foot where she'd been crippled by polio at age 7, and it had an enormous impact on her life. And she was teaching a class where she asked everyone to, you know, make some kind of self-portrait that revealed something about themselves. And for her, it was her foot that had been crippled by the polio.
It didn't stop her, though, did it?
It did not stop her. I think, honestly, it made her tougher because she just was a very determined woman. I think she was given an infusion of compassion by the experience of having a limp, that she said it made it so that she was never secure and whole when she went into a situation. But she went in with someone who'd already faced adversity. And I think it just made her really push herself to help others.
She died at 70. At that time, a lifetime that was not unusual for people to die at 70 in 1965. But I would imagine she felt like she had a lot of work to do when she passed.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. As she said, I have never, right before she died, she wrote a letter and said, I have not been able to break the habit of thinking everything is ahead. You know, she was so forward. She was so in momentum all the time that for her to stop, I mean, she worked up through, I mean, I remember these months very vividly because we lived across town from her. She was, you know, very, very thin, could barely eat, and she was putting together her final show at Museum of Modern Art in New York City, and she pushed herself just well past what most people could do.
Well, Dorothea Lange was the first woman photographer to have a solo exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art, and she photographed some of our most iconic images of the 20th century, from the Depression-era portrait of the migrant mother to gripping photographs of Japanese-American citizens incarcerated during World War II. Dorothea documented some of our history's most pivotal moments with unrivaled empathy and simplicity, and her work is detailed in all its wonder in Dorothea Lange, Her Lifetime in Photography, from our guest, Elizabeth Partridge. Thank you, Elizabeth. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and our guest is the unmistakable and incomparable Paul Arrigo, formerly Paul Arrigo from the great city of New Orleans, who now is head of Visit Baton Rouge. Good morning, Paul Arrigo.
Good morning, Jim, and if I need a good PR guy, I think I know who to go to.
There you go. Paul Arrigo, years ago.
That's right.
And Arrigo is a little easier on the ear, so you became Paul Arrigo.
Jim, I'm going to tell you how that happened. If I didn't mention this to you before or to your listeners, I was always Arrigo, and then my family came from Sicily, and they were all Arrigos, and my entire family in New Orleans was Arrigo. And I went to high school, and I played for a guy named Andy Bourgeois, mm-hmm. who was a Chinese bandit, and he called me Arrigo. And he also told me I was so slow, he would have to time me with an hourglass, and I didn't have time to stop him and correct it. So since high school, it's been Arrigo.
There you go. Well, we're glad you're in Baton Rouge. And for 16 years, this man has headed the group that is Visit Baton Rouge, and he is responsible for promoting our city here, there, and everywhere, and bringing notable events and people to Louisiana's capital, including, wait, don't tell me, you were a big part of that this
year. Well, myself and my staff were very much involved. Renee Arang was very much involved with bringing wait, don't tell me, which we've got some tremendous publicity on, and of course, in the next couple of months, in early 2014, it will air the LPB and PBS will air Antique Roadshow, which will do three episodes, which were filmed here already, and we'll get some tremendous publicity on that.
How much does that help in promoting the city?
Yeah, when you think about the demographics of 10 million viewers watching Antique Roadshow for three nights in February. So, you know, what else is going on in February? So we've got these relatively wealthy, heeled, traveling people looking at Baton Rouge and on for three nights and 3 hours in February. It's a tremendous opportunity to showcase Baton Rouge. We're excited about it.
Well, you're involved with an event coming later this month. New Year's Eve, Baton Rouge will be like it's never been before. What's going to happen?
You know, after 300 some odd years of this city being in existence, we're going to have a New Year's Eve celebration downtown at Town Square. And hats off to the mayor president's office and the other sponsors involved, Canes, Cox, Lasting Concepts, Coke, everyone that's involved, is that we're going to have a red stick drop from the pavilion, beacon down at Town Square at midnight on New Year's Eve in Baton Rouge, and we're excited about it because I think it's an opportunity for all of us Baton Rouge citizens to get together to celebrate the new year coming in. And it's a great opportunity for us to invite our out-of-town friends and family to Baton Rouge for the holidays and enjoy a great opportunity, a great time here in Baton Rouge.
Paul Arrigo's the guest. 16 years he's been head of what is now Visit Baton Rouge. You changed the name of the organization.
We changed the name. We had a football coach back in high school.
You changed your name. Andy Bourgeois did it.
Actually, Jim, what happened was throughout the years, convention and visitor bureaus and tourist commissions became more proactive in their name. Experience Columbus, New York, Inc., and several cities, Visit Baton Rouge, Visit Des Moines, what have you. So we thought it was a good way to brand our organization as what we do, and we're encouraging visitation to our community, absolutely.
When there's a big event in New Orleans, as you noted on an appearance on this show a little over a year ago, like the Super Bowl, February 3rd of this year. Mm-hmm. What does that do for Baton Rouge?
You know, Super Bowl had a big impact on what we did. We really worked that well through social media, particularly with the two teams, Baltimore and San Francisco, through their websites and through their fan sites. And we increased our visitation to Baton Rouge that Super Bowl weekend, which traditionally would have been a slower weekend because a lot of people don't travel because of Super Bowl. But we did quite well in February. I wish we had Super Bowl in New Orleans every year. Sugar Bowl this year, I don't know if we'll have any impact or not, although it's going to be two good teams.
Alabama and Oklahoma.
Oh, no question about it, yeah.
Will Nick Saban be with Alabama?
Oh, I think so. I think so. I think so. But then again, you know, who knows?
Yeah, he's been recruiting that great running back from New Orleans, Leonard Fournette, from St. Aug, a school you're familiar with.
Yes.
And I know LSU wants him mightily, the best player in the nation, apparently.
I've seen him on TV, and the kid is really, really talented. He really is.
He would be quite an addition to Les Miles' team at LSU.
Yes, he would.
The Tigers, when they're winning, as they have the last several years, it makes your job a lot easier, doesn't it?
Yeah, what happens with LSU, it's not just the visiting teams, the Alabamas, the Texas A&Ms, the Auburns this year and next year, the two Mississippi schools, Alabama and Kentucky. It's the alumni that fill Baton Rouge too. You know, we've got a big alumni group in Houston and North Louisiana, Tennessee, Texas, what have you, and they are the ones who use most of our hotel rooms. Although we do have some of the out of town teams. Fans stay with us, but as LSU wins, so does the community with economic development. Absolutely.
What does it do on a general weekend for football when LSU's in town, as far as the economy? Can you put a dollar figure on it?
Oh no, you know, I know LSU's doing that right now, and we're looking forward to that because it's been years since they have done anything like that. But if you look at 10,000 rooms in the Baton Rouge area filled for two nights for a big game like A&M or Auburn or Florida like we had this year, what's that, 15,000 to 20,000 people in town? You know, you're talking about millions of dollars of economic impact, but it's the fact that they're coming to Baton Rouge, they're having a good time, they're experiencing our community at its best, and then they go home and they say wonderful things about us. And one thing I have to say about LSU fans, I think as we've become to win more, we've become much more hospitable over the years.
There you go. Well, when you arrived 16 years ago as head of Visit Baton Rouge, you know, that was right around the time the Tigers were trying to turn it around, but 98 had a losing football season,
yeah.
99 had a losing football mm-hmm. season. It hurts, doesn't it?
Yeah, it did, and right before moving here, I was living in D.C., and that's when we were going through some really bad years, and then I think we brought in DiNardo, which we had a couple of bring back the magic, a couple of successful
three good
years.
Seasons and then two very bad ones.
But
you remember the Curly Hallman years.
I do. And how awful they were. I was living in D.C. at the time. And, mm-hmm. my God, thank God we didn't get it on TV every week because it would have been awful.
28 losses in 44 games through 4 years of the reign of Hudson Curly Hallman between 1991 in 1994.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, if that happened today, I think the university would go broke because of the expansion and the money that is necessary to keep the beast alive and well. And next year, 101 fans will be in the stadium. At least that will be the announced attendance when they're playing New Mexico State and Sam Houston State and UL Monroe. But the Tiger Stadium will seat 101,000 people come September of 2014.
Wow. And we're looking now at about, what, 94,000, 95,000?
Well, 93 is the...
93. So we're talking about an additional 8,000 mm-hmm. people available. Now, we know we have a lot of people mm-hmm. outside of the stadium that would like to go in, but bringing Alabama in next year, that should bring in the record at 104,000, are you saying there? And that's going to be wonderful. That's going to be more people coming in town, more opportunity to go to the games.
You know, in the suites, where I see you on occasion on Saturday nights at Tiger Stadium, mm-hmm. you're allowed to consume alcoholic beverages.
Right.
Should the fans in the regular seats also have that opportunity?
Well, you know, Jim, I'm not going to make a comment on that because you know, that's an LSU decision. But
I'm just asking an opinion.
Well, you know, my opinion is so insignificant. However, I think that from an economic point of view, we're going to see that beyond Tiger Stadium. I think we're going to see it in maybe other stadiums where there'll be lounge areas or pub areas. And I think that's going to happen sooner or later. And I think it'll probably be good for the sport.
Well, Paul Arrigo has been part of the revitalization of downtown Baton Rouge. And before you got here as head of Visit Baton Rouge around 1997, mm-hmm. We didn't have any active hotels downtown. Now we've got the Hilton, the Indigo, the Hampton, the Bell.
Right.
Can all those rooms be sustained?
Oh, I think so. I think that the economy is such that beyond the corporate transient business that comes into this community, we've done some good things with bringing conferences, conventions, special events. As you know, we've got a huge Bayou Country Superfest coming in, a three-day event this spring. So I think that that we're going to continue to grow the market to fill the hotel rooms, and we rely very much on local your listeners to help extend invitations to conventions, conferences that they're involved with, but even more so to invite out-of-town friends and family. So many of us here in Baton Rouge have friends from other communities because we've lived elsewhere or they've lived here, and I think it's important that we share the pride in this great community and invite out-of-town friends and family to visit Baton Rouge.
Bayou Country Superfest in May will include George Strait,
yeah,
who is living Country Stars Go. He's bigger than any of them.
You know, and we're excited about that third day. We think that it's gonna obviously increase the visitation, we would think, by 30-33%. People will be coming in Thursday night, staying Friday night, staying Saturday, staying Sunday. So great things happening here in the capital city.
George Strait, he'll be 62 on May the 18th. He's a huge, huge star, and this event has already been big.
Now, he'll be 62 May
the 18th. George Strait will.
Jim, you've got so much information in front of you. I'll be 62 on March 5th, so let's make sure
so
that everybody
you and George can have a joint birthday party, right?
I'm thinking the same thing. You know, he's a young man.
Huh? Yeah, 2 months and 15 days younger than you.
That's right.
But you're looking good for 60, almost 62 years old, Paul.
I've had
Rigo.
A good life. Yeah, I mean,
you've had a good life.
Yeah.
You grew up in New Orleans?
Yes, I did.
What part of town?
Gentilly, where my...
So did I, for 9 years.
Did you? Where?
I lived at 1954 Fillmore.
Oh, that would be a little further up.
That's close to Elysian Fields.
Sure, and that's, St. Raphael. And
that's where I went to school.
Really?
Yeah, where did you go?
I went to St. Leo the Great and... tell you who went to St. Raphael, famous LSU player named Tommy Morrell.
Went to St. Raphael, wide receiver.
Wide receiver and went on, I think, a valuable player in the Sugar Bowl of 68. But you would know that better
than
I.
Glenn Smith was the most valuable player in the 68 Sugar Bowl.
But he caught a touchdown pass.
LSU beat Wyoming 20-13.
That's right. And the punter was Jerry DePoister.
That's right. Jim Kick was their star running back. Remember him? For Wyoming.
I barely remember the game.
And Wyoming was undefeated. LSU in those days had connections. Jim Corbett was the AD, and they got in that game, which was a huge game, the Sugar Bowl, bigger than it is now, and it's pretty big. And the LSU got in that year with a record of 6 wins, 3 losses, and a tie, not ranked, and beat 4th-ranked and undefeated Wyoming January 1, 1968.
And the tie was to A&M or Rice?
The tie was to Ole Miss, 13-13.
Okay.
In 1968. LSU that year... had kicking problems, and they tied Ole Miss. They lost to 17-15 to Miami, 17-14 to Tennessee, and 7-6 to Alabama. And all of those games were kicking-related. They came close to having undefeated season, but we digress. Sports, though, big part of what you do, including bringing all these bowlers to Baton Rouge. That's
Absolutely. Big
business for our city, isn't it?
You know, we've got the women event coming back in 2017, which, listen, everybody, 2017, well, that's 3 years from now. And then the men, the Open coming back in 2025. When we were pursuing the event, we packaged the two together so that we would have something within the relatively near future. As you know, we had the men open in town in 2005, 2012. The women will be in 17 and the men again in 25. So it's spread out, but certainly economic impact. We know the men was $113 million in 2012, so we're thinking it'll be twice that much in 2025. And then the women in 2017, we think we'll approach $100 million. So we're excited about that, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Here's a question from J.C. Kane, our producer. She says, Baton Rouge, New Orleans, who has the better Italian restaurants?
At home at the Arrigo family. Actually, you know, the one thing that's missing in both cities is a true Italian restaurant because so much has become Creole Italian. But I would think, I think Baton Rouge can stand up with any other city, including my hometown of New Orleans with food, particularly Italian food.
So in Baton Rouge, the Sicilian, Paul Arrigo, where do you go?
Oh, you know, I like to go to Ruffino's. I like to go to Marino's and Gino's, and I like to go to DeJulio Brothers, and we've got some and the Little Village. I mean, we got some great Italian restaurants here.
Italian food is one of my favorites.
Sure,
DeJulio or DeJulio?
I say DeJulio, but I guess it's DeJulio.
I think it's DeJulio.
But you know, Jim, it's good that you brought up food because we were just recently voted by Convention South magazine by its readers as being the number one foodie city for conventions in Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida, and we're excited about that. We're also the friendliest people.
Is it because of transplants like you who have permeated the culture, or is it the people of Baton Rouge?
I think a lot of it has to do with a winning football team, and I think hats off to both LSU and Southern this year. You know, my goodness,
Southern's had a great season, no doubt about it, and LSU and Southern should play football. They should play in Tiger Stadium. If LSU is going to play UL Monroe, isn't it an insult not to play Southern?
Jim, you're asking me all these very controversial questions. Let's see, we want to have alcohol in Tiger Stadium. We want to play.
We do have alcohol in Tiger Stadium. It's for fat cats like Paul Errico, but not for the rest of us.
Thank God it's not Arrigo. And then we've got that. We want to play Southern. We have better food than New Orleans. My goodness, you're right. I'm all about it. Let's do it. Let's come to Baton Rouge and go to both games and have a good dinner.
Well, can you imagine the battle of the bands between LSU and Southern?
You know, I mentioned to the lieutenant governor when we did there was a video done on You Are My Sunshine by various Louisiana musicians, and I suggested that we include Southern and Grambling and LSU to play You Are My Sunshine. That's something I think we should do at every game. After all, it is this state song. It's probably the most recognized song throughout the state. Let's include that one, too.
I think it's the most recorded song of all time, written by the former governor, Jimmy Davis, who lived in three centuries. Jimmy Davis wrote it, and my favorite version of You Are My Sunshine, Ray Charles. What's your favorite version?
I like the original from the governor. I really do, because it's probably. But I do remember the Ray Charles, and it's a little bit funky. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Baton Rouge, come New Year's Eve, you're going to have thousands of people down there. This is a Kip Holden type of event. The mayor really thrives on this kind of stuff, doesn't he?
I think he does, and I think it's a great opportunity for this whole community to come out. And let's say we can get ready for the LSU game the next day, going down to Tampa. So New Year's Eve in Town Square. Celebrating maybe a little pre-pep rally for the Fighting Tigers the following day.
Another question, what about Visit Baton Rouge if we have the Village of St. George? Will it be the Visit Baton Rouge / St. George?
The way we were structured was to be supported and to support East Baton Rouge Parish and the area. So right now we are promoting East Baton Rouge, be it downtown, Sagan, Blue Bonnet, all of the community, Zachary Central. Our focus is on East Baton Rouge because we're supported by the hotel tax in East Baton Rouge Parish, and that's our commitment.
So you don't
and that's
think
our
the,
mission.
A breakaway city
I have,
would be a
I
good
can't,
thing?
I can't even comment on that because I'm not going to speculate on it. Right now, our purpose is to promote East Baton Rouge Parish, and darn it, I think we're doing a good job.
You are doing a good job of that. Paul Arrigo, a man who always has a smile, who will be 62 years old on March the 3rd. 5th. March the 5th. Let's get it right. So happy birthday. Have a great year, and we'll follow it with you.
You too, Jim. Thank you so much.
Take care. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and our guest is Max Allen Collins, the best-selling author of the graphic novel Road to Perdition, the basis for the Academy Award-winning film starring Tom Hanks. He is back with a major work. The book is Ask Not, Chicago, September 1964. Beatlemania sweeps the nation, the Vietnam War looms, and the Warren Commission prepares to blame a lone nut assassin for the killing of President John F. Kennedy. What happens, Max, as far as the aftermath of the crime of the century?
The approach I take in these novels, which are about a character called Nathan Heller, who's a private detective, is to go in and really, really research the crime as if I were going to do a nonfiction book. And then when I have that kind of information and that kind of take on the material, then I take my hero, Nathan Heller, into it. He's kind of a traditional private detective. What he's specifically investigating in this novel are the dead witnesses that started cropping up in the year or two after the assassination, these very suspicious suicides and outright murders and other deaths that were somewhat suspicious.
A lot of people did die suspiciously, there is no doubt. This is a novel, but it's a novel based on truth. Sometimes truth is stranger than fiction. What about mathematical possibilities? Could all of these people have just dropped dead so readily after the assassination, just a few years after what happened on 22 November 1963?
Well, it certainly seems unlikely, and there was another rash of deaths when the second investigation, when the House did their assassination inquiry. These center around basically the Warren Report, and the Warren Report is just about to issue its verdict on this particular crime, which was that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. And, you know, I know there are a lot of people that like to accept the so-called lone nut theory, but the problem with that is it isn't a lone nut theory, it is a two lone nut theories. You have to factor in Jack Ruby, who supposedly is another lone nut who just happened to come in and kill the other lone nut. I have almost all of these books are based to some degree in Chicago. Where this particular novel, we go to Dallas, we go to New Orleans. But the problem with Chicago is when you see somebody like Jack Ruby who has all of these mob connections, a lot of red flags should immediately go up. And in fact, the first thing that Bobby Kennedy said when he went in the aftermath of the assassination was, did the mob do this?
You also have a character named Mack Wallace. Tell us about Mack Wallace.
Wallace is somebody that I had actually not really heard of until I went into in-depth research on this phase of, you know, I've read a lot about the assassination over the years. And, you know, there's a lot of sort of kooky things that have been written about it. So you really have to have a good BS detector when you're reading this stuff. But Wallace turns up in the Billy Saul Estes matter, where Billy Saul Estes was an LBJ crony who got into all kinds of trouble running various scams. And a lot of the people around him began to drop dead suspiciously. And Mack Wallace, who was thought to be LBJ's hatchet man, is tied to a number of those suspicious deaths. That was the thing that really got me looking at Mack Wallace. Wallace is a convicted murderer. He committed a murder that he basically got away with. He was convicted and given a suspended sentence. That didn't happen a lot in Texas. Texas isn't real big on suspending sentences on convicted murderers. And he seems to turn up in some very interesting places, including in the so-called sniper's nest at the Texas Book Depository.
Yeah, his fingerprint was found there, wasn't it?
There's a fingerprint found there. Some people have tried to debunk that, but I think the evidence is there.
So you have a possible LBJ connection, a possible mob connection.
Right.
How could those two have come together?
Well, of course, it's a historical fact that the CIA and the mob were in bed together. This is not a wild theory. This is absolute historical fact that the CIA and the mob had in Castro an enemy that they shared. The mob wanted to get back into Cuba and get its casinos back and get its hold on the island back. And, of course, the CIA was interested in getting rid of a communist dictator who was less than 100 miles away from the United States. And so the CIA basically conspired with mob elements, people like Sam Giancana, Carlos Mucciello, who's a name people in your part of the world are familiar with, and to assassinate Castro. There were a number of attempts on Castro's life that obviously failed. And this was done with the knowledge of JFK and Bobby Kennedy. And I admire them very much, but they weren't perfect. This is a Shakespearean tragedy, in my view. When you have the President of the United States sanctioning the assassination of foreign leaders, then that can easily boomerang on you. And to some degree, that is probably what happened here. As far as LBJ himself, I don't really necessarily feel that he was a conspirator. I actually feel it's pretty unlikely that somebody who who wants to be president wants to see other presidents shot. However, there were a lot of people around LBJ, a lot of powerful people, particularly in Texas, who really, really wanted him in the White House. And there may have been some benign neglect on his part, but I would say I stopped short of saying, you know, this was a plot launched by LBJ.
The book is Ask Not, from Max Allen Collins, a Nathan Heller thriller. I don't think there's any doubt, based on your writing, that you certainly believe that Lee Harvey Oswald was not alone in killing JFK 50 years ago.
Right. I think there's a possibility he was, as he said, a patsy. I was in high school when the assassination occurred, and I saw all of this on television. I saw Oswald hustled around the Dallas police station. I saw Ruby kill Oswald right on television. I very vividly remember seeing Oswald, and I've seen these again. They play them from time to time. The way he behaved at the police station, the way, this is not somebody who's taking credit. Like, this isn't, you know, John Wilkes Booth shouting as he lands on the stage, "Death to tyrants." This is somebody who, from the beginning, said, "I didn't do this. I'm a patsy." And to me, that's another element of the so-called lone nut theory that doesn't quite hold up. These people usually want the credit.
Now, you're a prolific writer, and there's no doubt that Max has churned him out with the best of them. This Nathan Heller character first cropped up 30 years ago, didn't he?
That's true. The very first book was actually an assassination novel to some degree, because it was about the killing of Mayor Cermak of Chicago, which history kind of writes off as an attempt on the life of President-elect FDR. But most Chicago crime historians believe that it was a retaliation to an attempt on the life of Frank Nitti, who was Al Capone's heir, his second-in-command, and the guy who took over for Al Capone. And the other assassination novel I wrote took me to Baton Rouge for research. I did a book called Blood and Thunder with Nathan Heller that was about the assassination of Huey Long. And I did a good deal of research in your part of the world.
That was 1995, Blood and Thunder.
That's right.
About the 1935 killing of the Kingfish.
That's one of my favorites. And the novel. And all of the Nathan Heller books are back in print now. There was a period where you had a little difficulty finding some of them. But now all of them back in print. They're all on e-book and all available, again, in nice trade paperbacks.
There are several of them. Your inspiration, to some extent, is a man you got to know who wrote similarly, not exactly the same, but...
I'd say that's fair.
Mickey Spillane?
You're talking about Mickey Spillane. He was my childhood idol. I mean, when I was 13, I started reading those books, and I was very fortunate to get to know him later, and sort of his colleagues, and eventually just as good friends. He actually was the godfather of my son Nathan. So I've had a wonderful relationship not only with him but now with his widow Jane, and I've been involved in a project to complete unfinished novels that he left behind. He had a surprising number of novels in progress that he had for one reason or another set aside. And I have, at this point, completed 6 Mike Hammer novels that he had in progress,
right. And
2 others. And the thing, what's interesting about this is that, unlike a lot of the really famous detective characters like Perry Mason and Perot and so on, there were only 13 Mike Hammer novels. So it's not 70 or 100. And so these, to me, are very significant to get these books finished. And Mickey left a lot of notes, so I usually know what the ending is, and they've been doing quite well as well, too.
And no coincidence that your son is named Nathan.
No, the story about that is that my wife was expecting, and we knew it was going to be a boy, and we were picking a name out, and I said, well, I had just submitted the novel True Detective with Nathan Heller, and I said, well, if the book sells... you know, before you have the baby, he's Nathan.
Huh.
If the book hasn't sold, we got to go with something else because I will not have a little rejection slip running around the house. And the book sold.
Well, the novel preceding Ask Not was Target Lancer.
Right.
And it was about Nathan Heller looking into an alleged attempt to assassinate JFK in Chicago just 2 weeks before he was killed in Dallas. Now, do you think there were other assassination plots against Kennedy that did not come to fruition?
Yes, the Chicago plot came very, very close. I mean, the Secret Service in Chicago actually picked up two Cuban gunmen and had them in custody. Unfortunately, they didn't hold on to them. Kennedy was supposed to come to Chicago, and again, this is in early November of 1963, and he was virtually on the tarmac in Washington, D.C., ready to leave when they pulled the plug on the trip. It was going to be a motorcade just like Dallas. There was also a similar situation in Miami a week or so later where they controlled the they had the tip that there was a gunman in a high window, and they really controlled the appearances of Kennedy in a way because they knew it would be very dangerous. But it really does appear that this was, a plan A, plan B, plan C kind of situation.
Well, whether it's Frank Nitti or Amelia Earhart or Huey Long or John Kennedy, your research for these Nathan Heller books is such that I think you've probably become one of the most versatile historians around.
Well, I'm really, it's been a very interesting aspect of this that any number of my books, which are fiction, will be cited in nonfiction books later. And that's really unusual for fiction. Now and then I have had some problems where theories that I look at in fiction, some nonfiction author will pick up and do a nonfiction book on and not credit me. So that's happened as well. That happened not too long ago in the Black Dahlia case, where my research assistant and I found a whole avenue of that that had never been touched upon in any of the literature. And lo and behold, about a year and a half later, a nonfiction book on that theory came out. That's what happens when you deal with history. Everybody owns it.
Yep. Now, you have stated, Max, that you were not pleased at how the Kennedy assassination's 50th anniversary was reviewed and covered. You felt like it was not on the mark. Why not?
Well, I think there was a lot of sort of self-aggrandizing people, you know, getting misty-eyed about Kennedy and talking about where they were when they heard about it, and a real effort. And I don't say this was organized in any way, but there seems to be suddenly a real effort to just accept Lee Harvey Oswald as the lone assassin. Or I know Bill Maher on Real Time just said, well, basically, well, stuff happens. Just like, well, you know, it happened. Let's move on. That is a pretty short-sighted way to look at it, obviously. And I don't think it honors him and his memory to, you know, to sweep this under the carpet. But the Kennedy family themselves have been part of that, because they're, to really understand this, you have to look at some of these aspects that are uncomfortable. The idea that the Kennedy administration was involved, and Castro wasn't the only one, with assassination of other foreign heads of state. That opens a really dangerous door. It doesn't make him look that well. So there was a lot of Vaseline spread on the lens, on the camera lens. Let's just put it that way.
Do you think Oswald was involved at all?
I think he was either manipulated, or was a minor cog who was set up.
With Mack Wallace's fingerprint allegedly found in the sniper's nest, sixth floor of the school book depository, does that mean that he was involved?
I think he was involved. I do. That's my opinion, but it is based on a considerable amount of research. I mean, one of the things I try to do in Ask Not, and I do this in almost all the novels, is I will let these witnesses speak for themselves, and I will let the, you know, let the reader make the decision, him or herself. It's like, so when the character who is the historical figure who is LBJ's mistress, who bore him a son, and this is a historical fact, when she speaks, I am giving you what she said, what she wrote. Now, I don't. That doesn't mean I'm saying you can take it absolutely verbatim as truth, just that this is really what she said. Then you have to decide, is there some reason why she might be lying? And of course, I let Heller come to some conclusions as well.
Well, we thank you for joining us today. One of the most versatile writers on the planet, Max Allen Collins, is back.
Well, thank you so much, and it's great to talk to somebody who's obviously kind of dug into the book, and looks like you enjoyed it.
Yes, indeed. Ask Not, a Nathan Heller thriller from Max Allen Collins. Thanks, Max.
Thank you.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available online at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.